Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Called the first truly world war by Winston Churchill, the Seven Years' War pitted Great Britain and France in a titanic struggle to determine the fate of empire around the planet. Fought on five continents, the Seven Years' War saw the world's foremost two superpowers engage in the largest war in world history at that time. From 1755 to 1757, though, the war seemed to be fully in French control. In 1758, however, an innovative new strategy, developed by a brilliant new mind, turned the tide of the war and changed history forever. On this episode, we discuss the great finish to the Seven Years' War. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the colonial frontier of North America, the people and ideas that shaped it, and the places and events that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we'll be looking at part three of a three-part series, studying the Great Seven Years' War, a war that many call the first truly world war, and a war that will ultimately define the future and outcome of North America. Many will say that the end of the Seven Years' War, what we'll discuss in detail today, not only determined that North America would be a British holding, but also sowed the seeds of the American Revolution. Let's begin by reviewing the circumstances of the war from 1756 to 1758. In episode 1 of our discussion of the Seven Years' War, we spent our time defining what the war was and what was at stake. It was called by Winston Churchill as the first great world war, and we saw that it truly reached all corners of the globe. Anywhere that the empires of Great Britain and the Empire of France held colonies, it seemed that warfare would break out. We saw this war take place in many different places, everywhere from the Philippines, to India, to Africa, to Europe, to the Caribbean, and yes, the focus of our discussion, in North America. And everywhere the war took place, we saw that it was viewed by the people who lived there, although part of a larger conflict, in many cases its own meaningful conflict in its own right. In North America, the portion of fighting of the Seven Years' War was known as the French and Indian War. In India, it was known as the Third Carnatic War. In Europe, the war had many different names and was fought by many different peoples. Now, the early part of this war, we'll see, did not bend well in the favor of the British. Early on, the conflict we know stems from larger political circumstances from centuries before, but most of the early fighting tends to be provincial, mostly in North America. We saw that, through the calculated use of Indian allies, the French had created a strong and resolute defense on the North American continent. Now, the earliest fighting of the French and Indian War was technically not officially part of the Seven Years' War, and for the reasons of that, we discussed in Episode 1 of this three-part series. But they would be inseparable. They would be undivorceable from the events that would lead to the larger war spreading around the planet on five continents in Europe. Now, the year 1755 in North America for the British was one of mixed results, but mostly very bad. We saw a four-pronged attempt to defeat the French in North America, all of which ended in disaster. From 1756 to 1757, the second part of our three-episode series, we saw that because of systemic issues, because of institutional perspectives on war, and intended outcomes of the war. The French were overwhelmingly successful in North America. In episode 2, we highlighted these events in what we called the Years of Defeat. In North America in 1756 and 1757, the French were able to hand Britain a number of defeats that, if weren't defeating them outright, they certainly revealed many of the fatal flaws that the British Empire faced in the early part of the war. It's worth review, and we'll do it now. We have to understand, even though this is one large war, it's actually made up of many different component theaters of war, all of which are governed by an overarching strategy put forward by their respective empires out of their respective European homes. The British had a very clear plan of attack. It looked like this. They believed that as an island, their great force was never their army, but always their navy. And if there's one thing we can say about the British, it's that they always maximize the usefulness of their naval superiority. They believed that the way to defeat the French was to largely ignore combat in Europe, but take the war to their respective colonies. They'd focus most of their military attention as far as resources and manpower in places like India and the Philippines, the Caribbean, and North America. And the hope was that one by one, you could strip away these French colonies and therefore take away literally their empire from beneath their feet. The French had a very different viewpoint. If the British were to focus the war in colonial fighting, because again, there's no easy way to fight a world war, the French would focus their effort largely on the continent of Europe itself. France is surrounded on all sides, it seems, by people who could be viewed as enemies or allies. So they began to focus their efforts in Europe itself, because they believed that if they could win the war in Europe, they'd have to bring the British to the negotiation table anyway. And when that happened, they could simply barter or deal or negotiate for whatever land they lost from Britain's larger colonial strategy. Now, who were they fighting if the British were focusing so much on colonies and the French so much on the continent? Well, the British effectively outsourced the fighting in Europe to an ally known as Prussia in a grand alliance. The British would say, let the Prussians handle the fighting in Europe. We'll handle the fighting around the world. That was the general game plan. And what you saw there was a great disconnect, mostly responsible for what the British would call the Years of Defeat, 1755, and certainly 1756 and 1757. When we compare the systems that the British and French will use and the overall strategy that the British and French will use to fight this war, we see inherent weaknesses on either side, because each of them are gambling and effectively betting on separate horses. The French system in the colonies seems to be strong. They have good leaders, and they have a sound strategy to fight around the world. Focus on Europe, allow the colonies to defend themselves. That was the plan. And because of that, each of the respective regions where the war is being fought, North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and India, have their own regional leadership who will implement their own regional policies that work best for them. For the French early on, this works very well. But remember the British. They largely abandoned Europe to their Prussian allies to defend, and they also fought their own form of fighting around the world. Well, this is where the difference really reveals itself, because the British early on never have an effective or efficient command structure. In some places, things are going quite well. For example, as bad as it was in 1756 and 1757 in America, things were going very well for the British in India. Why? Well, you had this general disconnect from the empire trickling down to their forces. In the colonies, largely, the fighting was done on all sides by provincials, by colonists, who seemed to have more of a stake in their own regions, which would help to strengthen the empire. So when we look at the issues the British have, what we can say is they are largely systemic. There needs to be a complete overhaul for the war to turn in their favor, because at this point, in what amounts to the largest war in world history at the time, the British are badly losing. And even worse, they're badly losing to their perpetual and eternal arch nemesis of France. So that's where we're going to begin our new study and our new evaluation of the French and Indian War here in Episode 3. What great change do they make? Well, no individual change in no individual area, whether it be North America, India, or the Caribbean, will ever give them the worldwide results they need to change a global conflict. So the war is going to have to be changed first and foremost at the place farthest removed from the war itself, in London. And the change comes in an interesting way. The power and the decision of the war was largely divided between two men for the early years of the conflict, the Duke of Newcastle and William Pitt, the Earl of Chatham. It was not an efficient system. It was not an effective system. It trickled down into a lot of pretty nasty and pretty useless politics in many cases. Men like Abercrombie, who were given control of the, say, Army of North America, really didn't deserve the job, really had no military experience to speak of. And often, this very ineffective system breaks down into small bits of very frustrating and very simplistic minutia like that. Well, the big change happens first in 1758, because William Pitt will take over sole control of the military. So regardless of whether the strategies he puts forwards are good or bad, what we can say is they are one clear strategy. And to that point, the British really didn't have that. And again, a worldwide conflict fought on five different continents. So what does William Pitt do? William Pitt will be the architect of the new British perspective, the new system for attacking the French. And he says this, where are we going wrong? Well, in some places we're doing well, in most places we're doing poorly. What are the common strands? Well, the first common strand that he sees is that most of the fighting, particularly in North America, and North America in the British mind, is the great prize of the war. We'll see how it plays out later in the peace agreement that ends the conflict. He sees that most of the fighting is being led by British officers, but being fought by raw, untrained British militia, that is, the American colonists themselves. He says we do have British regular soldiers. To this point, we haven't used them, not in the way we should. So that's his first step. Use actual British regulars in the conflict. It will be more expensive, but in the end, it's an investment he hopes, and it will, pay off. The second part is his recognition of how the French run their empire, and we've talked about this many times in the series. The British have a very slow-growing empire that's very solid. It's a land-based empire. The French, particularly in North America, have much of more of a water-based empire, much more of a circulatory network, using rivers, lakes, to connect their entire North American empire back to its heart of Montreal and Quebec. He recognizes that, and he recognizes the importance of crumbling that system. And he looks at critical points, particularly in North America, because again, that's where the most contentious fighting has been, and the one that's most gone against the Empire of Great Britain. And he sees that if you can remove a few key strategic points, you can effectively cut the French Empire into pieces by snipping its line of communications at a number of very important and very specific points on their North American circulatory waterway network. The two most critical to him, he believes, are first, their great fortress at the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, their great aorta of empire, the fortress at Louisbourg. The second will be the fortification that protects their great superhighway to the west, the Ohio River, known as Fort Duquesne. And we covered in early episodes of Wartime in Season 1 how these fortifications developed and where they came from. There will be a third target he'll mull over, which will sit on Lake Champlain, which effectively is the direct waterway south out of Canada to the modern city of New York, known as Fort Carillon. In the future, that will be called Fort Ticonderoga. If those three pieces can fall, William Pitt believes, now effectively operating as what we would think of as Secretary of State, controlling all of Britain's military affairs, then the war in North America will turn around in their favor quite drastically. So we'll begin to break down these efforts, some successful, some not, and talk about why in the grander strategy they're all much more important. We'll begin with Fort Duquesne. When we talked about the establishment of Fort Duquesne in earlier episodes of Wartime, we mentioned that, on its own, per se, it's not a particularly overwhelming fort. It's very weak by nature. It's made of walls of timber about 12 feet tall. It really only holds less than 200 men. It could never sustain or protect itself from a major European attack. It was also never designed to, and that's critically important, something when we talk about New France, we often don't think of. Fort Duquesne is strengthened and supplied by the fact that it's connected through waterways, the Allegheny River to French Creek to Lake Erie, Lake Erie to the Niagara River to Lake Ontario to the St. Lawrence River, to the heart of New France, the place where it will receive supplies, ammunition, and even reinforcement. That's the key. Fort Duquesne is only as important as the network which it is a part of. That's the idea. So if you can capture Fort Duquesne, it could be relatively easy. But the French also know that rebuilding it or recapturing it is just a matter of sending troops down through that circulatory system to that point. It's an advantage the French have always had in North America. While the British were trying to build roads, the French were using the God-given, we can say, superhighways already provided for them in the forms of lakes and rivers. Well, first things first, if you're going to capture Fort Duquesne, it has to be done permanently and effectively. So how will you do that? Well, it's going to be very difficult, it's going to be very tedious, but it's also going to be very permanent. William Pitt will effectively devise a strategy where you will build a network of roads mimicking what the French have with waterways, with actual passages, with actual roadways through North America. The man he will assign to capture Fort Duquesne is critically important to this process. He's an experienced soldier. He's a lifetime soldier. He's a Scotsman. His name is John Forbes. Now, John Forbes is a hard man. He has dedicated his life to the service of his empire, and he greatly believes in the worldview that his empire represents. As a Scotsman, he has a penchant for being perhaps a little more braggadoche than your average British soldier. It's one of the endearing qualities of the Scotsman that the British will always exploit for the rest of their history when it comes time to fight. But John Forbes will build an expedition in the city of Philadelphia. In the 18th century, Philadelphia is the largest British city in North America. It sits in the eastern half of what today is Pennsylvania, and it is effectively a coastal city. Now, there does take some maneuvering through some waterways, but Philadelphia is a busy port. What the British want to do, and Forbes will really lead on this, is march a force out of Philadelphia, marching directly westward until they reach Fort Duquesne. Now that sounds easy, but it's actually very difficult, because to get there you have to traverse a number of very big natural challenges, and that does not include the challenges presented by the French or their Indian allies. If you can visualize the state of Pennsylvania today, it's largely where this story takes place. The state is effectively divided in half by a large chain of mountains called the Allegheny Mountains. These are part of the larger Appalachian mountain chain. Those mountains have always been the western edge of the British world in North America, up and down the Atlantic seaboard. What Forbes will have to do is not only march over those mountains, but then continue to do so until he reaches Fort Duquesne, all the while moving very slowly, because he's going to be building a road in the process. He's going to be clearing trees and, most importantly, building forts along the way. What he's going to build is what the French have already done using waterways earlier that decade. We call it, in military strategy, a line of communication. Remember, coming out of Lake Erie, stretching all the way to Fort Duquesne, the French have three other forts north: Fort Machault, Fort Lebeuf, and Fort Presque Isle. It's a line of communication for supplies, for information, and even reinforcements. The British will do the same. Along the way, stretching from Philadelphia to Carlisle, there's already pre-existing roads, but from there, John Forbes and over 5,000 men will carve a road and build forts all the way to Fort Duquesne. They'll use this road to receive supplies, reinforcements, and information. Sounds familiar. It's a line of communication. Along the way, Forbes will build a number of very important forts. Fort Loudoun, Fort Bedford, and Fort Ligonier. What he's done is created a permanent connection and a permanent supply line for the first time west of the Allegheny Mountains, west of the great Appalachian Mountain chain that's been the effective edge of the British world to that point. Fort Duquesne's strength was always the fact that it could be easily reinforced and easily retaken through waterways, and the fact that if the British ever wanted to attack it, think Braddock's expedition of 1755, they'd have to snake their way through a very alien wilderness, once getting to Fort Duquesne, effectively being alone, severed from the rest of the British world. The French had the advantage, but not anymore. With the construction of that road west, we call it the Forbes Road, what we see completed is a great equalizer in North America, but not even an equalizer, something that makes the British much more superior. It's not a waterway, but it's a permanent line of communication with forts along the way. They're taking the land and holding the land. So let's set the scene. It's November of 1758. John Forbes and about 5,000 other men have been marching their way toward Fort Duquesne. And all the while, the native spies are gathering intelligence and telling the French, there is a very big force bearing down on your position. John Forbes himself will never be there to capture Fort Duquesne. He's actually suffering from an illness. He's suffering from cancer. He's in his final days. And he never moves beyond Fort Bedford. Again, it goes Loudoun, Fort Bedford, Fort Ligonier. Fort Ligonier is about 50 miles from the forks of the Ohio, from Fort Duquesne. John Forbes will stay behind, but he will send forward a force to capture Fort Duquesne. But this, if you are a Frenchman, if you were in the fort itself, is something you cannot predict. It's something that you cannot fathom a way for you to win. There's only 200 Frenchmen in Fort Duquesne. There are several hundred Indian allies in the vicinity, but you yourself really can't protect the fort, not with a force bearing down on you, with a permanent roadway, a permanent line of communication back to the east. The French have no choice but to abandon Fort Duquesne before John Forbes' expedition even gets there. It's a major British victory, led by a group of individuals that aren't John Forbes, even though it's called the Forbes Campaign. After a certain point, he stays behind. One of them is a young Swiss mercenary named Henry Bouquet. The other, a young Virginian, you guessed it, named George Washington. Fort Duquesne falls without a shot being fired. The French abandon the fort, they explode their powder magazines within, and they make sure that even though they know that they won't have it, the British won't either. They destroy the fort, the British will arrive days later, and the great victory of the Seven Years' War to that point is finished without even firing a shot. Really, an impressive sight. But this is a symbolic beginning of the end of New France. When Fort Duquesne falls, the British will forever cut off and sever France's great hope to reconnecting with the Mississippi River and joining the Louisiana Territory with their own heart of New France in the St. Lawrence River Valley. It's the beginning of the end, but it's not the end yet. The fall of Fort Duquesne is a symbolic victory that is worth some very real consideration. But where does it go next? Because again, the superhighway to the west is done. Well, from then, British forces in North America, controlling the east and controlling the west, will begin to close in on the French from all sides, until hopefully they believe, moving on and capturing the heart of New France, the cities of Montreal and Quebec themselves. The British world is overjoyed to hear about the fall of Fort Duquesne. and the fact that it happened, again, without even a shot being fired, reveals just how tenuous French control of North America really was for its entire existence. If you can cut off the waterways, or minimize those waterways, the rest is history. The British will begin to build a fortification on the site of Fort Duquesne, much larger, much more powerful, built up literally from the earth itself, and they'll call it Fort Pitt, named after the great Secretary of State, the great decision maker who came up with this plan, William Pitt. Today, it's the city known as Pittsburgh, named after William Pitt. But the rest of the story will take us to other reaches of North America, because again, you can visualize the plan. The Western Wall has been built by the British. Fort Duquesne is gone. The Eastern Wall is being built by strategically located blockades using the British Navy along the French coast. The rest of the story is going to be about closing in on them, pinching the French in until you completely surround them and obliterate them in their own capital city of Quebec. It was all part and parcel of William Pitt's continual strategy to close off the French. And again, the Western push, which we've just discussed, was only part of the story, because 6 weeks earlier than that, on the East Coast, we saw another critical piece of the infrastructure of New France begin to fall, and it was the fortress at Louisbourg. Now, it's very hard for me to convey this over the airwaves, but the fortress at Louisbourg was much more than just a fort. It sat at the mouth of the St. Lawrence River. It was much more like a town than a small fortification. It was the key component, we can say, for the overall imperial health, defensively, of all of New France. The British, with their navy, had attempted to take the fortress at Louisbourg once in 1757, which, if you'll remember, ended in failure. It was a combination of bad administration, poor leadership, and very bad timing, as a storm broke up the attempt. But again, William Pitt has a vision for how this should look. And this new vision utilizes the mighty and powerful British Navy. Now, the story sort of goes like this. The French are undersupplied. They've been undersupplied because the British have been blockading their ports in North America ever since William Pitt took over in 1758. As the war moves on, Louisbourg becomes weaker and weaker, and it becomes more and more indefensible. The British Navy is just too powerful for the French Navy. But again, it's a different strategy for fighting the same war. The French strategy and the British strategy. The British will surround the fortress at Louisbourg, and they'll put it under siege. And this is a very large siege. It's the largest siege in the history of North America. Again, a siege works on the basic principle that if you build walls around a city, they're excellent for keeping people out, but it can very easily be used to keep you in. The siege of the fortress at Louisbourg surrounded the position and effectively choked it out. In July of 1758, the position fell, and the British would occupy it for another 8 years, going forward until 1768. So already you have two major victories for William Pitt's new strategy of changing the war, and it seems like these are changes that are necessary for the overall success of the conflict. The third branch of that is not so successful, and it's an attempt on Fort Carillon, in the future that will be called Fort Ticonderoga. There is a charge led on Carillon, it is repulsed, and it's largely repulsed by a dual alliance of French and Indian allies at the time. But overall, Fort Carillon in the Lake Champlain-Lake George corridor is not as essential as the other two, because what William Pitt has done, particularly at Louisbourg, is given himself a place he can launch an attack toward the heart of New France itself in Montreal and Quebec. And by 1759, that's exactly what he'll do. It must be clear, and we can't understate this, that 1758 is the year that really begins the turnaround of the conflict. But it's not a year in which the French feel defeated. It's not a year in which the French, I suppose you could say, see the writing on the wall that the end is near. By 1759, however, and you do always take a break in fighting from 1758 to early 1759 because of winter, It serves no European army to fight in the middle of the cold. It's still an axiom of militaria today. 1759 will be the great turnaround. It will be the great payment, the great dividend from the investment of 1758. The British will call 1759 Annus Mirabilis, which is the Year of Miracles, because it seems that one after another, not just in North America, but in the world, victory after victory after victory emerges from the conflict as a whole. For example, in 1759, we talked about the attack on Fort Carillon from 58. The tide begins to turn. The commander of Fort Carillon will abandon the position, as we saw at Fort Duquesne, and the British will occupy in 1759, changing its name to Fort Ticonderoga. It's an Indian word. It means the place between the two waters. So that's a major British victory. But again, the real target is Quebec. And the way it plays out is overwhelmingly impressive. The British will find Quebec as a very heavily fortified position. Quebec sits on top of a large plateau. Now, this has been the heart of New France for some time, and it's not going to be an easy nut to crack, and they know that. And before they can really capture the city, they've got to soften the outside. Quebec City today is a beautiful city. If you ever have the chance to visit, or if you're nearby, it's worth the trip. It truly feels like a uniquely European experience in the New World. It's also one of only two cities left in North America that still have its original defensive walls in place. So you really can see this in action as you're there. But they will see from the British, led by a general named James Wolfe, is a 3-month siege of Quebec itself, because again, to charge the position straight out would be disastrous. And this is a maneuver you really want to take your time with if you're the British, because again, you've only began to turn the war around in 1758 and in the midst of 1759, and you can still be easily repulsed and still lose everything if you don't play your cards correctly. Well, sure enough, after a 3-month siege, and, interestingly enough, a 15-minute battle at the Plains of Abraham, the British will capture the city. And the finish to the battle is nothing short of poetic. The British General James Wolfe and the French general that's been in command in New France for the entire conflict, Louis-Joseph de Montcalm, both are killed at that battle. Again, Benjamin West immortalizes it in a great painting, The Death of General Wolfe, but it's a poetic finish to a very long and very meaningful war. Now, if you believe we've skipped over, say, the capture of Fort Carillon, if you believe we've skipped over the capture of Quebec, or we've minimized it to a degree, you're probably right. But the fact of the matter is, we really want to get to, as historians, what's the crux of the conflict, and that is the finish. From 1760 to 1762, the fighting in North America is largely finished. The fighting will continue in other theaters of the war, but the large portion of combat in North America that we're concerned with is done. It will be one British victory after another until 1763. Again, we're minimizing the battles so we can really focus on the biggest question in history. And that's a question you always should ask. And the question is, who cares? Why? Why is it all so important? Well, this is what we'll say. The year 1763 has been called by some as the most vital year in American history before 1776, and here's why. 1763 will see the official ending to the entire Seven Years' War with an agreement we call the Treaty of Paris. Critically important, because it determines not only the fate of empire in the world, but also it determines the fate of North America. It seems unbelievable when we consider how important the North American continent will be in the future of the world. But at the end of that conflict, with the French defeated, what you'll have are ministers from Britain and France and their Spanish allies. The Spanish are involved in this conflict at the end, and they too will be the losers. will be basically taking the world and dividing it into pieces between the major superpowers. The British are victorious. They have the leverage in the debates. And the rest of the losing powers, the French and Spanish, put up almost no fight at all for the taken and conquered territories in North America. They want their Mediterranean holdings back. They want their Caribbean holdings back. They want their very wealthy and very profitable African coastal holdings back. But North America, the French effectively just give to the British with almost no fight. They're very interested in the West African coast. The Spanish are very interested in getting back Cuba, Havana, that was taken by the British in the later years of the conflict. But North America itself is given almost wholly to the British. This will ensure that the future of North America will be a British one. You always hear historians joke. If the British lost that war, the Americans would all be speaking French. It's humorous, it makes the situation very easy to understand, but it's also a very revealing insight into the power of empire. But North America's future is now a British one. The French will ask when they're expelled from the continent, Canada, all of it will be British as well, that their French-speaking minorities, if they choose to stay, be allowed. So long as they begin to adjust to the British system. They can speak French, they can remain Catholic, they won't be forced out. It's an interesting little glimpse of perhaps a bit of progress socially in this very changing world. But the results of this conflict are immense. And the trickle-down effects of the end of the war, which we don't often think of, are almost unavoidable. And here's one of the most important. When the British begin this conflict, their imperial debt is about 74 million British pounds. 74 million British pounds is their imperial debt. Remember, in the American world today, we count our debt in the trillions, not the millions. We spend millions by the second. But theirs is a modest 74.4 million pounds. Now, we know in the 21st century, long wars are expensive. And this is a war that is at least 7 years long, therefore, the 7 years war. But you could even push it as far as 1753, and even beyond that. By the end of this war, the imperial debt of the British Empire will not double, but reach 122 million pounds, from 74 million to about 122 million. And that puts the British in a very big pinch. Because yes, they are victorious. Yes, they have literally doubled the size of their empire by taking French holdings as a result of the conflict. But they've got this terrible and long debt to pay off. And it's here that we see many of the earliest origins of a lot of the complaints and grievances of the American Revolution really emerge. Imagine if you're an American Briton at the time. Your great enemies have always been the French. Most of the fighting in the 7 Years' War, although it was fought on five continents, have been in North America. And you, the Americans, as proud British citizens, have defended your way of life. Patriotism and love for the British Empire has never been higher than it was in America in 1763. Until the retribution. You expect, perhaps, a pat on the back by the Empire. Thank you for the victory. Thank you for your hard-fought sacrifice. But instead, you get none of that. What you hear is that the imperial debt is now the issue, and the onus will fall on you to take care of it. The British will believe that because most of the expensive fighting was in North America, the Americans should provide the funds and resources to deal with the debt, because the debt has to be handled. They believe the Americans should pay the taxes, the revenue increases to handle the debt. And they also believe that the Americans could deal with most of the austerity, that is, the spending cuts, to help offset the debt. So if you're an American, you've never been more proud to be British. You just have a victory in the greatest war the world has ever seen. And rather than a great attaboy that you expect, your taxes go up, and the money spent on you is cut. These two decisions, these two policies by the British, are very risky, but to them very sensible, To the Americans, though, it becomes a symbol of what will become in the future, at least politically, the great tyranny of empire. All of a sudden, your great anxieties you may express toward the empire begin to emerge after this great victory. The Seven Years' War is a very meaningful and successful win. The Americans think they stand to benefit the most. It's an interesting fact, but about 50% of the British Empire's entire wealth come from North America. So these colonists seem to be in the driver's seat, and they're happy to be British. George Washington, for example, retires to Virginia to continue to climb the British ladder of success in a very British world. However, the implications of paying off the debt from the war, revenue increases, having your taxes raised, and austerity, having spending cut, reveals itself in many ugly and terrible ways if you are a British administrator trying to control a world larger than any empire that the world has ever seen. The British have a system of governance. We talked about this in an earlier episode of Wartime, the British system. But the system itself is not capable of dealing with an empire this big, and the results for them will be catastrophic. They'll not only lose the North American colonies to revolution, largely stirred on by sentiments from raising these taxes and cutting the spending, but they'll also have their entire British worldview challenged. The Seven Years' War is inseparable from that event. It's why we study it the way that we do. It's why we spend so much time with it. And it's why more historians need to spend time dealing with the intricacies and the nuances of the Seven Years' War, because the world it creates from 1763 and beyond is a very different one. The revolutionary period begins in 1763. It doesn't begin on Lexington Green in 1775. It doesn't begin with any Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia in 1776. It begins with the Treaty of Paris and the aftermath that the colonists have to confront. The French and Indian War is a great laboratory of empire. The Seven Years' War is one that we can really, as historians, sink our teeth into, because there's still so much to learn, and still so much new ground to be broken. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.